During those last days in May, General Eisenhower's forces were assembling around the south coast and up the west coast of these islands. So also, most unfortunately, did the depressions in the Atlantic, so that by the 30th, 31st of May, Tuesday and Wednesday, there seemed on our weather charts to be nothing but a series of great depressions with almost winter-like intensity. On the evening of that Wednesday, the 31st of May, even then I advised General Eisenhower that conditions for the oncoming weekend, especially over Sunday night and Monday morning, the crucial times for Overlord, were going to be stormy. But we went on with the meetings. I had to go before General Eisenhower and his commanders twice a day during those fateful days, 1st, 2nd and 3rd of June. As the time went on, the seriousness of the whole situation got worse, until by Saturday night, the 3rd of June, it became obvious that there would certainly be a storm in the Channel area on the Sunday night and Monday. General Eisenhower decided to halt the operation.
It was cancelled for 24 hours, and then we had the all clear to go. And I always remember the Padre walking into the centre of the compound with a cross. He stuck it in the ground. And he said, "We don't need a church, lads. Come here and pray." And everybody, even the Naffy girls that were there, they was all round the Padre.
At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were told, "Stand down, it's off." And we were given the reasons. They said the weather is broken and it's unlikely that we shall be landing, certainly not for the next 24 hours. And they were going to make a decision by midday on Sunday. And every man, Jack, whatever his religion, all went to church. It didn't matter what denomination you were, whether you were agnostic, atheist, Church of England, Roman Catholic, Presbyterian, Jew. You stood at some church and you were being blessed by someone.
Sunday, the 4th of June, was a day of dreadful tension. The whole operation was hung up. Our charts gave no indication whatever that there could be any respite from the storms for many days ahead. We knew that the operation could be held up for only one day. The only alternative was a fortnight ahead, when the next tides would be suitable. Then, mercifully, almost unbelievable happened about midday on that Sunday. We spotted from a report from the Atlantic that there might be an interlude between two depressions moving towards Ireland and therefore ultimately into the southwest approaches. If that interlude could be long enough, and if it arrived in the channel at the proper time, it might just let the thing get started again. By the evening, my own confidence in the forecast for this quieter period had so increased from further reports that had come in that I convinced General Eisenhower and his commanders that it would indeed arrive later on Monday after the storm of Sunday night and continue through Tuesday and probably into Wednesday. The next morning, early on the 5th of June, they met again to confirm this decision. And when I could tell them that we were even more confident than we had been the previous night that the quieter interlude would indeed come along, the joy on the faces of the Supreme Commander and his commanders after the deep gloom of the preceding days was a marvel to behold. Well then, there it was. In the early hours of Monday the 5th of June, General Eisenhower made his final and irrevocable decision for the operation to go forward again.
But what we all felt, and this was the most astonishing thing, I think, about the Normandy landing, is that everyone was 100% confident that whatever happened to me or to anyone else, or perhaps to the Hampshires, that it would be successful. there was no question of thinking that it might not be. And I think everybody was quite glad to get on with it, because it was like the sort of green light for the end of the war.
To prevent the enemy from building up reinforcements so quickly that he can push you back into the sea, you have to do two things. First, you have to have a deception plan to make him think you're going to land quite somewhere else and make him build up all his reinforcements and his defenses there. That was easy in our case. It obviously was the Pas de Calais, the Straits of Dover, the shortest way across, because not only did all the German generals think that we were going to go there, but all the British generals wanted to go there. Secondly, having got them all concentrated in the wrong place, you had to then prevent them from being moved to the right place when they discovered their mistake. And for that purpose, you wanted weeks of interdiction bombing, destroying roads, bridges, railway junctions, tunnels, and everything. And for that purpose, the whole of the main British and American bomber commands had to be turned onto the job way ahead of the actual D-Day.
The operation was called Operation Taxable, and it was, I think, one of the biggest spoofs that was ever played on the Germans. The raid was carried out on the night of the 5th of 6th of June, 1944, and the object of this exercise was to simulate a landing of troop carriers and troop ships across the Channel to Calais area of France, to try and put the Germans off the scent of where the real D-Day landing was going to take place down in Normandy. The object was for 8 aircraft to fly in rectangular orbits, as it were, at a steady speed of 200 miles an hour at 3,000 feet, dropping out bundles of window, which window being strips of metal foil, which once released into the air gave a blip on the German radars. From intelligence sources, they had calculated that the radar blips appeared every 12 seconds, and so we had to drop out bundles of window every 12 seconds. We would fly for 32 seconds ahead, turn onto a reciprocal course and fly for 30 seconds, and then turn again and fly ahead on a forward course for 32 seconds, and then turn again and fly for 30 seconds, so that we were slowly, slowly moving forward. We had to fly line abreast 8 aircraft with something like a mile distance between the aircraft, but it was all pinpointed over the radar navigation. All the timing was absolutely synchronized so that we all got on our positions and started at the same time. In each aircraft there were 2 pilots and 2 navigators, because the work was so concentrated that we had to have a break every so often. And we had 3 additional people in the aircraft with stopwatches dropping out the window at 12-second intervals. They'd drop a bundle out, and as soon as it hit the airstream, it would scatter, and then they would get the blips coming through on the German screens. The only way that we know it was successful was that it did tie up a tremendous amount of German reserves in that area. We know that they thought something was happening, because we could see from the French coast, all the coastal guns were firing the whole time, just aiming across at the Channel, hoping that they would be lobbing some shells in amongst this spoof landing.
200 ships were each equipped with 2 to 3 kilowatts of Mandrel jammers, which were used on that one night only basis. When Eisenhower said go, everybody on board their ships, wherever they were, threw this big master switch, which was marked one thing, which it wasn't. It was really a Mandrel jammer, which we told nobody about. But when you threw this switch and you were in Salcombe or wherever you were going to come from, it didn't affect the German radar at all. As you approached the coast of France, all the German radar operators would see is some hash on that bearing, you know, which could be a faulty tube, you know what I mean, a faulty valve. And it would get worse and worse. The German radar people on that particular night were sitting in his tiny little operations rooms, cut off from everybody, just a telephone to pass plots to. The wind's blowing, it's raining, and the tea's lousy, and everybody's unhappy, and it's approaching dawn, and the wind's blowing, and it's been raining all night, which is what happened on the night of D-Day. And everybody's just waiting for a chance to go home. There's a fug in the ops room, and this is the kind of situation you had. And then all of a sudden, the front end of the receiver goes on the blink. Now, that when the front end of a receiver went faulty, you get hash. You give it a tap, and it stops, and it starts. But it's doing hash, and you'll be tired out and fed up and waiting to go off duty, and it'll be getting worse and worse. And then finally you'll be saying, well, to hell with it, let's not touch it tonight, let's wait till the mechanic comes on duty and then replace the tube, and everything will be all right. But by the time first light came, all the capital ships were in position. You know, some were laying 3, 4, 5 miles offshore with their big guns. They're all lined up there, and when it got light, in fact, that picture in The Longest Day where you see the officer in charge of a gunnery's post suddenly seeing all the ships was exactly how it happened.